You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The rapid technological innovations over the past decade or so has had a profound effect on American business. Today, businesses have to adapt to changes quickly or else. Think how quickly Blockbuster went from being a market leader to bankruptcy. And given all the potential changes coming from Washington today, from healthcare changes to visa changes to renegotiation of trade agreements or the effects of Brexit across the ocean, how can businesses be prepared to quickly adapt and deal with unforeseen consequences of these changes? Well, my guest today says a strategy that has become increasingly indoctrinated in the military could provide the key. Red teaming is a set of tasks and tools designed to challenge assumptions, expose hidden threats, identify missed opportunities, and stress test plans and strategies. These techniques help businesses see how customers, competitors, and other key constituencies will react to moves they make in the marketplace before they make them. It can also help to take advantage of disruptive events such as changes in U.S. business policies. Red teaming has increasingly become a standard operating procedure in the U.S. military, and my guest, Bryce Hoffman, says savvy businesses are also beginning to use these tools. Hoffman is an award-winning financial journalist who spent 22 years covering the global automotive, high-tech, and biotech industries for newspapers in Michigan and California, and the author of the 2012 bestseller American Icon, Alan Mulally and the Fight to Save Ford Motor Company. He's now a management consultant and became the first civilian to graduate from the U.S. Army's famed Red Team Leaders Course, an elite program at Fort Leavenworth for senior military officers that's recognized as the gold standard for Red Team training around the world. His new book is titled Red Teaming, How Your Business Can Conquer the Competition by Challenging Everything. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Bryce Hoffman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
Now, the term red teaming, when I think of the military, I think of opposing forces going back to the Cold War and even further beyond that, back to General Mitchell, who proved that the Air Force could destroy battleships, and of course it got him court-martialed back in the 1930s. But as you use the term red teaming, really comes out of the last decade and a half, if you will. What do we mean by red teaming?
So red teaming is a system that was developed by the military and intelligence community after 9/11 to help organizations challenge their own assumptions, to stress test their strategies, and to make better decisions. But Rich, you know, you're absolutely right. Its roots run very deep, and it runs right through that wonderful story you just shared about General Mitchell, a classic example of red team thinking in action that the military drew on when it formulated this modern approach to red teaming. The difference is that we've now got decades of research into cognitive psychology and human decision making that the military has been able to leverage to formulate this modern concept of red teaming that is really designed to help us overcome our biases and blind spots that we have as individuals and as organizations.
And those biases are just, there are a variety of biases, but it's basically wanting your opposition to do what you hope it will do, right? I mean, that's a big part of a lot of the biases. You're hoping they're going to do what you expect them to do.
That's definitely part of it. You know, researchers like Dr. Daniel Kahneman, the Nobel Prize winning economist, have shown, though, that there's just a dizzying array of things, of shortcuts that we take, of biases that we have that are just kind of hardwired into our thinking, that we just, no matter how smart we are and how well-educated we are, we just can't overcome. I'm going to give you an example that most of your listeners will probably be familiar with, is sunk cost bias. It's the reason why you see people sitting on the edge of Las Vegas wearing just a T-shirt and their pants because they've lost everything else, is because our brains are wired. When we invest money or lose money, we want to get it back to the point that we will often do incredibly irrational things to try to get it back, like continuing to gamble after we've already lost, the money we came to Las Vegas with. But companies do this too. You know, think about all the companies that have built a factory, and that factory has just been losing money since day one. But instead of just doing the obvious thing of shutting it down and cutting your losses, they continue to keep it running, to keep putting products there, in an effort to try to recoup the money they spent on the factory, they end up often spending three or four times that much money before they finally give in and admit they're never going to get a return on their investment. That's just one example of dozens that have been identified, and these are the things that red teaming is designed to help us overcome.
So how did red teaming get going? You mentioned it began after 9/11, but you tell the story of how it got started, because I would think within the military, it's such a hierarchical organization that a lot of commanders would think, well, this is going to directly challenge my viewpoint or the viewpoint of my staff in what we do. And that's really the point of red teaming, is to constructively challenge the prevailing assumptions.
You're absolutely right, Rich, but it does it in a way that's not threatening to leadership. And that's why it's been so able to succeed in the military and why military leaders have been, as a whole, so receptive to it. Because red teaming is not, the red team doesn't make decisions. The red team doesn't formulate the plan. It makes the leader's decisions better and it makes the plan better. So it's really just another tool that the leader of an organization has to employ to make better decisions, to make better plans. And it grew out of a recognition that we learned the hard way in Afghanistan and to a greater degree in Iraq, that a lot of the assumptions we made when we invaded these countries turned out not to be true. And in retrospect, it was really easy to identify the reasons they weren't true. But because we didn't have a rigorous process to examine our assumptions before we went in, nobody looked at these things. So I'll give you one example that I learned from the military that I think is people can really relate to, which is that, you know, we have a bomb that we use and it goes off in the air and it scatters carbon filament. And that carbon filament floats down and lands on power lines and it can short out a nation's electrical grid. And we used it in the Balkans War against Serbia. And we blacked out Serbia, and it was a very effective tool in bringing that war to a hasty end. But, you know, Serbia is a temperate climate. And we decided that it would be a great thing to use this same bomb all over Iraq and take out Iraq's power grid, too, without stopping to think about what the consequences of that would be for a population that lives in a desert in terms of refrigeration, air conditioning, and drinking water.
So you literally put them on the knife's edge as far as overall survival of the civilian population.
Exactly. And, you know, people, you know, I've talked, one of my instructors when I was studying this with the Army was literally one of the planners of the invasion of Iraq. And he said, you know, in retrospect, it was immediately obvious to all of us that people don't really care if they live in a dictatorship or a democracy, if they don't have drinking water and a way to keep their meat from rotting. But we were so focused on the idea that people were going to be so happy to be out from under the heel of Saddam Hussein that we didn't think about the consequences of these actions on the civilian population. And that's one of the things that we did that helped provide fuel for the insurgency that later arose.
You tell the story in the book, and I believe it's one of those people you were talking about who brought in a Shiite cleric into Kuwait City before the invasion. And it was sort of a way of getting intelligence, and they were peppering him with questions about the status of the roads. And at one point, the cleric says, "How long are you planning on being here?"
Exactly. That was Colonel Steve Rotkoff, who is really the person who spearheaded the Army's effort to develop decision support red teaming. Parenthetically, he's now my business partner. And Colonel Rotkoff was the number two intelligence officer during the invasion for the ground forces during the invasion of Iraq. And he was part of this meeting with this Shiite cleric, as you say, Imam al-Khoi. And the CIA brought him in. He was going to be our man in Iraq, quote unquote. And he was brought in to answer all these logistical questions, as you said, Rich. But after listening for a few hours to these questions, he got impatient and said, "Let me ask you a question. How long are you guys going to stay in my country? Because that's really the most important question." And their response, you know, this was only a few weeks before the invasion. And the response was, "Well, we plan to be out by December." And he was incredulous. And they said, "Well, you know, look, you know, it's just going to be like Paris in 1944. You know, we came into Paris. You're like France. You have resources. You have oil. It's best that we come in and get out of the way and let you rebuild your country." And he looked at them and he said, "You're crazy. It's not going to be like Paris in 1944. It's going to be like Yugoslavia the day after Tito died. Everybody's going to start killing everyone else. And if you leave, you're going to leave us in a situation that's far worse than the one we're in now." And keep in mind, this is a person whose father had been killed by Saddam and stuff like this. And he said, you know, as much as I hate Saddam, if that's your plan, you got to call this whole thing off. And Colonel Rotkoff, writing back to the base after this meeting, was like, why didn't we have this discussion months ago? Why are we talking to this guy with just weeks left before we invade the country? It's too late to turn back now.
Yeah, and really everything he predicted came true. He predicted the sectarian violence in Iraq. He predicted just about everything that came about after. And you know, and what's interesting is those generals were probably parroting an answer they thought he wanted to hear, really, that they weren't going to be there forever. They weren't going to be an occupying power. They were going to let them rebuild the country. And it's just that's one of the biases you're talking about that red teaming can expose.
Exactly. And that's, you know, one of the generals that was involved in that planning told me, you know, we have this problem that we assumed that inside every Iraqi was a little American just dying to get out, is how he put it. And that neglects centuries of history and a different cultural experience and different realities. They, you know, what people who were opposed to Saddam in the country really wanted was the U.S. to help them rebuild their country in a post-Saddam world. And, you know, the as you pointed out, not only did everything that he predicted come to pass, Imam al-Khoi was actually one of the first victims of that sectarian violence. He was assassinated just days after the liberation of Baghdad.
Hmm. Now, once red teaming sort of came into the military in a formal way, what have been the biggest successes that you can talk about at this particular point?
Yeah, you know, Rich, that's one of the challenges is most of the work that the U.S. military's red teams have done is classified and isn't really stuff that can be talked about. But one very visible example of how it worked and worked very well initially was the 2007 troop surge in Iraq. So if you and your listeners will remember, you know, then President Bush gave the military the direction to pull out of Iraq. And using the red teaming tools that had then been developed, were applied to this problem and realized that if we want to pull our troops out of Iraq, even though it's counterintuitive, the way to do that is to put more troops into Iraq. And so General Petraeus came up with this plan that people may recall of sending 30,000 more troops to pacify the country and basically create the conditions for the U.S. to withdraw in an orderly manner. And it worked. The violence dropped off dramatically. And for several months, it just got less and less. It seemed like everything was working well. The problem is that the military doesn't, at the end of the day, make its own decisions. The politicians do. And so when it was working so well, people decided to declare victory for political reasons before the surge plan had the full time that General Petraeus had requested for it to work. And we pulled out prematurely and everything started to fall apart. But if you look back, you know, later, even politicians who opposed the surge initially, like then Senator Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, later went on the record saying that they thought it was tremendously successful. That was one of the first public products of red team thinking in the military. But it raises an important point, which is red teaming can only work if the leadership of the organization is willing to let it work.
Now, one of the things your book makes is that now you're starting to see business use red teaming. Who are perhaps some of the best-known companies that use red teaming regularly to make decisions?
There really aren't any at this point.
Oh, really?
It's new. I mean, this is the reason I wrote the book, Rich, was to bring this concept to businesses. Now, that said, there are some companies that have begun using this and have begun using it very successfully. And, you know, for competitive reasons, I can't tell you who all of them are. But, you know, one example that I can give you is an insurance company in New England, a health insurance company, whose name everyone would be familiar with, that created an in-house red team and gave it the task, the chief financial officer of the organization who oversees the red team in that organization, gave them the task of figuring out how to put themselves out of business. In other words, he said, you know, pretend you're our competitors and figure out how to put us out of business. Now, you might ask yourself, why would you do that? Well, this team within this organization then set about figuring out how to put themselves out of business, figured out two potential ways that a competitor could put them out of business, and then began developing plans to counteract those measures. Guess what? By the time they'd finished, one of their competitors had actually started down one of those roads, but they were able to kind of nip it in the bud because they saw it coming and knew how to deal with it because they had red teamed it. That's one example of red teaming in action. Another example that I can talk about is a company that I've worked with that's a global company that had a new CEO come in and was charged with creating a turnaround plan for the organization. And he asked me to, after he and his executive team had developed this turnaround plan, to come in and lead them through a red teaming analysis of it. And what that analysis showed was that in a couple of key areas where they thought they were really addressing the fundamental challenges that the company was facing, they in fact were solving the wrong problem, if you will. And we were able to help them identify what the real problem was in those areas and revise the plan so that it was addressing those core systemic issues. And it's been very successful now that it's being implemented. You know, the thing about red teaming is that it's been so successful in the military that it's now been adopted by many of America's allies, the British, the Canadians, the Australians, the New Zealanders. NATO has begun creating its own version of red teaming. And I think when businesses learn about this and when they see it in action, they will be even more eager to use this. Because, Rich, if you look at it, this is one of the things I talk about in the book. Some of the best companies already do this organically. You know, they don't know the term red teaming. They don't call it red teaming. But they do many of the same things that red teaming teaches organizations how to do. Just as a matter of course, companies like Amazon, companies like Toyota, have processes that are just part of their DNA. And that's one of the things that really was a proof point for me that this could be a powerful thing for business, was seeing how similar it was to some of the best practices that we see in these companies.
You tell a story pretty early on in the book about a Toyota CEO coming to Detroit to give a speech, you know, right in the jaws of the enemy, if you will. And you talk about how some of the people who heard this speech were amazed that he was talking about all the future challenges he saw for Toyota at a time when Toyota was creeping up on Detroit, but still behind like GM, for example. And they're thinking about the future threats that they're going to face that GM hadn't even thought about, or you know, Detroit hadn't even thought about. And he said that was a real eye-opener to that executive, that they were not even really focused on Toyota and the Japanese competitors, and the Japanese competitors were already looking to the next generation of competitors.
You know, Rich, I will never forget that speech because I was there for that, and that was Fujio Cho, who is then the chairman of Toyota. And Cho gave this presentation. He gave a PowerPoint presentation where he went through slide by slide and showed how Toyota was not just hitting its targets, but exceeding its targets in every single market in the world. And after he went through this presentation, he took his glasses off and he looked out at the audience and he said, "That's why we have to reinvent our business." Now, I mean, you could have heard a pin drop in that room, Rich, because here you had most of the people in this room were American automobile executives. They were still trying to figure out how to get to where Toyota was then. And now the head of Toyota is saying that where we're at isn't good enough. We're going to go someplace even farther. And they did. And over the next few years, they passed General Motors, became the largest automaker in the world, became phenomenally successful, even more so than they had been. And they were able to do it because they weren't satisfied with where they were at, because they knew, and he explained this. He said, you know, today, no business can afford to be satisfied with where they're at. Any business that's not willing to change is going to go out of business. That's what he said in this speech. And it's so true, because, you know, you look at companies like General Motors, they persisted after that and saying, look, you know, we just need the American people to give us some money and we'll keep doing what we're doing and make it through this economic crisis. And they went bankrupt. And meanwhile, Toyota just kept getting stronger and stronger because they were willing to change. And today, whether you're a small mom and pop business or a global company like Toyota, you're in the same boat, because the business environment in this country and around the world has become so unpredictable, has become so disrupted, has become so complex, that if you don't disrupt yourself, somebody's going to disrupt you. Every taxi driver in America has learned that lesson, Rich, the hard way.
That's right, Uber.
Exactly. And so my point is red teaming is a way to do that. Red teaming is a step-by-step system that I explain in the book that companies can use to have that, to disrupt themselves and to challenge themselves rather than waiting for one of their competitors or a competitor they don't even know exists yet to do it for them.
My guest today is Bryce Hoffman, a management consultant. He's the author of American Icon, a biography of former Ford CEO Alan Mulally. And his latest book is titled Red Teaming, How Your Business Can Conquer the Competition by Challenging Everything. He's the first civilian to go through the military Fort Leavenworth Red Team Leaders course. It's an elite program at Fort Leavenworth for senior military officers. He was the first civilian to graduate from that. And he lays out how to red team, and he says this really should be a process of business. So how would red teaming work in a typical business, a medium-sized, large business, or even a small business? Does it involve taking people from their normal task and putting them to work, thinking about alternative ways for the company to invest in projects, to not invest in projects, or and how do you just keep it from being sort of a naysayer, if you will, sort of a alternative reality sort of thing, where you're just sort of looking critically at everything and not necessarily recommending a path forward?
That's a great question. So let me start with the last part of that question, Rich, which is, how do you keep the red team from just being a group of peanut gallery critics? And I talk a lot in my book about how to red team correctly and how red teams need to be constructive rather than destructive. You know, there's a big difference between being skeptical, which is what red teams need to be, and cynical, which is not helpful. So red teams need to ask tough questions, but they need to do so in a collegial and constructive way. That's the first point. So you're set to the first part of your question about how do you bring red teaming into an organization. As I talk about in the book, there's an array of models for red teaming, and they range on the easiest end. You can just look at my book, which takes you step by step through these tools and techniques, and use them as part of your planning process. That's not formal red teaming, because formal red teaming requires you to have another set of eyes look at things, but it will help you make better decisions as a business leader. On the other end of the spectrum, you have, like the military has, standing red teams staffed by trained red team members. And if you're a big corporation, that's something that you may want to consider doing. In between, there's a whole bunch of other options I talk about, including having, you know, one member of your organization get trained in red teaming so that they can kind of facilitate red teaming exercises as needed in your company, or you can bring in an outside red team facilitator to lead your organization through one of these exercises. That's, you know, both of those are things that my company does, and we found them both to be very effective, training people in red teaming and helping facilitate red team exercises.
Now, when is the best time to red team and when not to? Given the pace of corporate disruption today, I would say that almost any time is the time to red team, but there are times when you shouldn't red team. For example, you tell the story of Netflix and Blockbuster, how Netflix went to Blockbuster pretty early on and said, hey, would you like to buy us? We have this online portion that you're not doing very well online. We're starting to do well online. You buy us and we'll, you know, run the world as far as video rentals. and they kept coming back to Blockbuster, and pretty soon it's Netflix running the world and Blockbuster's in bankruptcy. So what is the right time and the wrong time to be red teaming?
Well, you know, the Blockbuster story is such a great cautionary tale, Rich. I mean, you know, Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, talks about how they were laughed out of their office every time they went and made this proposal. They offered to sell themselves to Blockbuster for $50 million. When the last Blockbuster store closed after they went bankrupt, Netflix was worth $12.5 billion. So, you know, it's easy to look at the guys who are running Blockbuster and say, boy, what a bunch of idiots, huh? But they weren't idiots. They were people who were blinded by the success that they'd had to date and by their own understanding of the video rental business. And they weren't willing or able to look at it as an outsider. If they'd had a red team, then they could have said, hey, we've got this crazy proposal from these guys, you know, who want to create this online business to rent movies. We think it's ridiculous, but why don't we give it to the red team and see if they can they can make the case that this is actually a good decision. And if they did that, they might have seen some really compelling evidence that this was the direction the video rental market was heading. And they might have been able to take advantage of the opportunity, the golden opportunity that Netflix was offering them to sell themselves for almost nothing. So that's a great example of when you could use red teaming. But there are times when you don't want to use red teaming as well. One of the first lessons they taught us at Fort Leavenworth, Rich, is don't red team when the enemy's in the wire. And you know what that means for businesses is don't red team when you have to make a decision right now. You know, they're red teaming. It's not about you know, kind of creating an institutional group of navel gazers. It's about finding, you know, using it judiciously at the right times to evaluate your strategies and plans and your decisions and make them better. So you can use red teaming at the beginning of the planning process. There's a lot of tools that you can use up front to help develop insights and alternative perspectives that your planners can draw on as they formulate their plan. And then you shouldn't red team. Then you should let your planning staff develop its best plan and then bring the red team back in and have it stress test that plan to make sure it's really the right plan, to make sure the planners haven't missed anything. Because one of the things that again, Dr. Kahneman says that I love this quote, which is that it's a lot easier to see a minefield when someone else is about to step in it than when you are. And that's what the red team provides, is that other set of eyes to say, hey, wait, guys, you're about to step into a minefield. Let's take a step backwards here. So those are the kind of two areas that you use red teaming most effectively, at the beginning of the process and at the end of the process. Now, in between, you can use some of these same tools and techniques as part of your regular decision making. But, you know, most decisions that we make don't require this level of analysis. You know, like I talk about in the book, if you want to know what the right price is to pay for some Class A commercial real estate in downtown Chicago, you don't need to red team that. You need to pick up the phone and call a commercial real estate agent. You know, it's not about overthinking things. But if you're trying to figure out whether it makes sense for your company to open an office in downtown Chicago, that's something you might want to red team.
Yeah, interesting. All right, well, the name of the book is Red Teaming, How Your Business Can Conquer the Competition by Challenging Everything. It comes from the military, and it's a sounds like a powerful technique that more and more companies are investigating as the pace of business continues to quicken. And I just want to follow up. Your first book was on Ford CEO Alan Mulally, who, of course, turned around Ford. Now Ford has just fired their successor to Mulally, Mark Fields, in part because they thought that the company wasn't moving quick enough. That just seems to be the pace of business today, is that everything is going to be moving lightning fast.
You're right. And this is, you've just got to why I wrote this book, Rich, is because, you know, Alan Mulally was someone who did this naturally, who did this organically, who asked these tough questions and kept Ford moving rapidly in the right direction as a result. And when he left, Ford lost a bit of that. And so that's what led me to seek out this system, was to find a way to teach companies how to have that sort of contrarian view that Alan Mulally brought naturally to Ford.
Hmm. Well, the name of the book is Red Teaming. Bryce, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Rich.
Bryce Hoffman is a former financial journalist and management consultant. His new book is titled Red Teaming, How Your Business Can Conquer the Competition by Challenging Everything. It's published by Crown Business. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.